Thanks, Jim. So our next speaker this morning is Erica Herr from Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. She'll be speaking about the DNR Lands and Minerals Mining Hydrology Program.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Again, Erica Herr with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I'm the Mine Permitting and Coordination Supervisor with the division, and I've been in this role for a couple years. Previously, I was the Mining Hydrologist with the division. So I'm going to talk to you about our mining hydrology program and the waters unit and the work that we do. We do a real mix of technical and regulatory work, and I'm going to go over that and also give you a couple examples of some of the technical work that we're doing. So just to introduce you to our unit, our mine permitting and coordination section is made up of staff from both St. Paul and Hibbing. And I work in the Hibbing office along with Ted, and who you heard from earlier this morning. So this section is made up of a few different units, and everybody is involved in, you know, kind of a mix of technical and regulatory work. So we have our mining hydrology program, or our waters unit, and that is made up of one mining hydrologist, and we have two assistant mining hydrologists. We work very closely with the reclamation unit, and they work on administering the permit to mine program. We also have some research staff, and part of their work involves doing research at the Hibbing site. We have a lab and an outdoor research site there. We also work with some planners who are very helpful in keeping our projects moving along. And we have one wetland specialist. We're actually in the process of hiring a second wetland specialist, and that's very important to our work because any work that requires a permit to mine, the DNR acts as the RGU and implements the Wetland Conservation Act. So they help regulate wetland impacts from mining. Our program is a statewide program, but you'll see as I get farther into the program that most of our work is along the Mesabi Iron Range. And we work on projects that involve ferrous, non-ferrous, and peat mining, and some municipal water use. We do both regulatory and technical work. So what we do is we administer for the regulatory portion of our program, we administer the Public Waters Work Permit Program and the Water Appropriation Permit Program. And I'll be just talking about water appropriations today quite a bit. We only implement those programs for projects that require a permit to mine. So that is why we're just talking about ferrous, non-ferrous, and peat. You just heard from Jim about some aggregate dewatering. That type of work would require an appropriation permit, but because the aggregate mining does not require a permit to mine, the Division of Lands and Minerals does not administer that program. It's administered by the agency within the DNR, the Division of Ecological and Water Resources. For our technical work, we do some of our own monitoring. We have quite a few monitoring wells and some surface water that we monitor. We also participate in special studies. So if our permit to mine program has the reclamation staff has a question related to mining hydrology for some of their permitting, or if there's mining hydrology related questions in any of the environmental review, we'll be called on to help out with a technical review. So again, statewide program, but because most of the active mining, of course, is, or at least the ferrous and non-ferrous is along or near the Mesabi Iron Range, this is where most of the work we do is. So this is just a map showing where the majority of the work is, but where the major taconite operations are. Ted mentioned scram mining a little bit. So on the western end of the range, we do have some scram mining operators, some that are no longer in operation, but we've got some new ones that are potentially gonna be coming in. We also do have Polymet Mining, who's a permitted operation. They are the one non-ferrous operation that is permitted and operating, I shouldn't say they're not quite operating yet, but they're permitted. Ted also mentioned peat, and that it's, a lot of it is in this wetland area of mostly St. Louis County, Aitken County. This is just two of the locations of the peat mining operations that we work with and permit. And again, most of them are within the Floodwood, McGregor, Cromwell area where there's, a lot of the bogs and peat bogs. Though we do have a permitted peat mining operation in the northwest part of the state that I'll be talking about as well. So the Mesabi Iron Range, again, Ted set this up really well for me, this morning. The Mesabi Iron Range is where a lot of our work is going on. It's where all the, you know, the right now the active taconite operations are. Although there are other iron ranges, as you saw, that you know, mining has occurred in, you know, past history. It was shown by kind of the lightning bolt shaded area on my previous slide. And so it's a deposit of iron ore. It's over 100 miles long. So mining of the high-grade iron ore began in the late 1800s, you know, 1880, 1890. As that went on and some of that higher-grade ore was depleted, they started with taconite mining in the 1950s. The individual ore pits that were originally mined were typically very small, very steep-sided. But as you'll see later on in my presentation, some of those, as they were dewatered, of course, during active mining, but as they have filled with water, they can often create big, large pit lakes, you know, that are big pit complexes and very large water bodies. As you can imagine, the landscape across the Mesabi Iron Range has changed quite a bit from the mining. Mining did generally start out, you know, doing it with underground mining, but they went to move to surface open pit mining. And as technology progressed and equipment got bigger and we had the introduction of rail, definitely the impacts became larger, pits became larger, operations became larger. So we do have a lot of changes on the landscape. You know, if you come up to the Mesabi Iron Range, if you're not from there, you might think it's very hilly. It's really not. It's fairly flat, but we have, there's a lot of stockpiles and a lot of them are old. They have vegetated, you know, and they look like hills. So it looks like there's, you know, definitely a lot of topography there. But so what that has done, though, is also changed the hydrology and impacted watersheds across the range. So I was just talking about surface landscape changes, but we do have a lot of underground landscape changes. So around, I think it's about 2008 to 2010, the DNR assisted with an underground mine mapping program. And the purpose of this was to try and map using old maps, a lot of scanning old maps and digitizing old maps was involved with this project, but to try and map all the underground mines across the Iron Range. And so this started in the very east end of the range near Bowabic. It didn't get all the way to the west of the Grand Rapids area. I think the farthest west it went was about Nashwauk. But again, mapping the underground mines, you know, very important, but how that ties into mining hydrology, of course, is now we have these conduits, underground mining that just adds to the complexity of, you know, that connection between surface water and groundwater. So as we, you know, try and look at impacts or if we have questions about what's going to occur, you know, there's a lot of assumptions and a lot of unknowns, but this underground mine mapping project helped us a little bit better understand, you know, what could be going on underground that we can't see. So we have a little animation, the pre-mine landscape. So this is a typical cross-section of what you'll see on the Mesabi Iron Range. So the Bowabic Iron Formation, which is where they mine, is overlain by glacial drift or the overburden. So, you know, glacial deposits, sand and gravel. And again, the BIF or the Bowabic Iron Formation, you know, dips to the south, kind of the southeast. And so definitely most of the mining is going to be where it's shallower and where there's less overburden, and also trying to stay away from having, of course, to mine, go through the Virginia Slate, because, you know, like Ted said, it gets very expensive as you move to the south, and drilling is deeper. So you have the natural landscape. So what happens when they mine is they, you know, dig a big hole in the ground. You know, some of the materials used, some of it, of course, is side cast, and so now you have a stockpile. And so what these open holes are then is they're sinks for surface water and groundwater. So you're going to get precip falling right on these pits. You're going to get surface water runoff coming onto the pits, you know, water that infiltrates the stockpiles that runs in. The overburden or the glacial drift, of course, is a great aquifer. So we got a lot of water coming in and moving in through the glacial drift. And then you also have some water that does move through the Bowabic Iron Formation, mostly in the top layers where it's probably more weathered and where there's fractured, but we do see a bit of water coming in through the BIF. So then, of course, what happens, the pits fills with water. So during active mining, they dewater the pits. little bit of, you know, if you know your water cycle, a little bit of water is lost through evaporation. But the mining operations will then need to dewater. And so usually most operations, it's a mix of what they do with the water. Some operations, they, you know, some in some areas, they'll discharge directly to a stream or river. Sometimes they just are moving it from pit to pit. Sometimes they move it to their mine for to help for processing. But this is then what requires a water appropriation permit. So this is where the regulatory part of our program comes in. So water appropriation permits are required. We have both statute and rule that guides the program. You know, and generally the policy is that, yep, we recognize that water is a resource and that can be used, but we also want to make sure that it's done in the right way and that we minimize any adverse impacts. So water appropriation permits are required for an appropriation of over 10,000 gallons per day and 1 million gallons per year. So, and of course, most mining companies hit that. And permits are required for all waters of the state. So that covers surface and groundwater. So this is from an actual mining operation. And this just is a good illustration of how water is moved around on site. So this is very typical of what you'll see at a mining operation. So you can see that, you know, if you, I don't know how well the colors show up, but the orange are points of discharge, the yellow are where the installations or where the appropriation or taking point is. And then that dashed line, or those are pipelines. And again, that's very typical. A lot of water movement. You'll see this comes up. I don't know how well this is showing, but this is a tailing basin, so some water is moved up to the tailing basin. Water is moved definitely from pit to pit, and we have here at this operation two surface water discharges. And again, just some pictures. So this is a sump, so sometimes they just have floating pumps, submersible pumps in the pits. Sometimes they use barges. This shows a pipeline, if you can see it going up the hill. They pipe water large distances, and you know, again, sometimes it's moved on site for processing, and sometimes it's discharged directly on stream. So for what, when we're looking at water appropriation permits, all this water movement is very important to us. The DNR, when they issue water appropriation permits, requires permittees to report annually on water use, and so the amount of water that's being appropriated is important for, you know, that overall use. But in the mining hydrology program, it's very important to us to understand that overall picture, how water is moving. And so there's a lot of monitoring and you know, tracking of water movement on site. And this becomes really important, one, just to help us make better water management decisions, and but two, also when an operation may shut down to get a bit, it'll, all this information can feed into a closure model, which is very important. So just being kind of forward thinking and thinking about what kind of data we would need in the future. So an example of a operation that had a fairly recent permit, this is a Ruchelot pit complex this is the city of Virginia. This is United Taconite's operation. And so this is a pit complex made up of three separate pits. At the very north end, you have the Mesabi Mountain. In the middle is the Chamus, and at the south end is the Ruchelot pit. UTAC was interested in mostly just dewatering the Ruchelot pit, or the pit to the south, so they could mine the active mining area that you see, the pit to the south. So not really mining in the Ruchelot, but dewatering the Ruchelot was very important for really just to keep water out of the area they're mining, and also to reduce the head, because of course if they're mining, you know, deep down below, they want to bring that water level down above them, down to a more manageable level. You'll see Highway 53, which is crossing the south end of the pit complex, was located down around the south end of the pit, so they had to reroute that. So if you're not familiar with that, the bridge opened in 2017, and it's the tallest bridge in Minnesota. It's pretty fantastic to see. But we had to, you know, again, when we're looking at water appropriation regulations, think about what kind of impacts there could be from this project. So we have the city of Virginia here again, that their municipal water supply is in this pit. So again, like, what would dewatering this pit do to, you know, potential impacts to the city's water supply? We had another appropriator, the Minorca Mine, takes water out of this pit to move to one of their pits, which they use for processing. So two previous appropriators on this pit. So that's something we have to consider when an appropriator comes, you know, to us or a permittee looking to use waters. Are there other appropriators there? And then of course downstream impacts from the discharge. Okay, so they're discharging through the south. So we had to look at, you know, what are the potential impacts downstream? Can the channel handle the flow? Are there going to be, you know, is there culverts that are properly sized? There's a lake downstream. Could the lake levels potentially be impacted? So a lot, just an overview, you know, the kind of things that we consider, the kind of things that we have data collection for. We have operations do a lot of monitoring and modeling to help, you know, answer some of these questions about potential impacts. But so just to take a maybe a historical view of the pit. So in 1991, mining was no longer going on. The pits were starting to fill with water. So as you could see, the three separate pits in that previous slide, and now you have one large body of water. 2015, you can see starting to prep for the dewatering and the bridge. Now the bridge going across in 2018, which is about when they started dewatering, I think in 2019. Just a couple drone pictures, as you can see the drawdown. So now one of the land bridges now is visible. So again, we just have the separate Rousselot with the rest of the pit. I will also quickly talk about peat mining. If you're not familiar with peat mining and how they operate, they remove the top material from the site and they ditch to try and dry off the peat mine or the peat so they can mine it. So, you know, the amount of water that they use just really mostly depends on how much they're getting, mostly, you know, rainfall, right? And then and how dry it is and how much evaporates, because they're just really looking at that the top layer there of the peat. Then they use these big vacuum harvesters to remove the peat. Most of our peat mining permits were issued in, you know, probably like the late 80s, 90s, you know, some maybe in early 2000. This is this Hawks company, which is north of Thief River Falls, if you're familiar, is one of the few operations we have not on the Mesabi Iron Range. But they came to us for permitting in, I think it was about 2007, maybe a little bit earlier. They're doing environmental review. But definitely the ditching lowers the water table in the area. And so when we start looking at impacts, we are concerned about what kind of impacts, not so much, I mean, potentially downstream impacts from the water, additional water, you know, into the stream or the receiving water. Not a lot of water leaves the site, but also, you know, considering the drawdown near the ditching. So this hatched area that you see is the mine site, generally where they want to mine. You know, the blue shaded area around there is delineated wetland outside of the, you know, actual permit to mine where they're mining. And this is a fen. It is not a calcareous fen, but it is a fen. And so there are some wetland species that are a little bit more rare, a little less common, that were identified in this wetland area. There's not a lot. There's some. And again, you know, a lot of the peat mines are permitted a long time ago, and we don't have a lot of data collected on them. So not a lot of information out there about you know, drawdown and what the distance that you'll see a drawdown from a ditch. And so because we wanted to address the potential for impacting this wetland around this the peat mine, all these M numbers are monitoring wells that this operation has installed for monitoring wells. So they did some transects up on the north end because this is where the wetland species that we're concerned about are located, but also quite a bit of monitoring around the site. Again, just to help us better understand and be aware of any potential adverse impacts, you know, before they get to the point where we can't mitigate or we can't do some kind of adaptive management. So that was a quick run through of the regulatory part of the program. For the technical work that we do have a number of monitoring wells and a handful of surface water sites that we monitor. I've mentioned that companies, when they get permits, water appropriation permits, are required to do monitoring, but you know, that's, you know, a little more site specific and to answer specific questions. So we have our monitoring network that we have just to help us better understand, you know, range-wide, better understand the connection between surface and groundwater hydrology, and just really better understand what is going on the across the Mesabi Iron Range. So we have a lot of the wells have been installed for a number of years. We have recently installed some new ones with the help of our Division of Ecological and Water Resources. They help with the superficial wells. We did install some bedrock wells, and I'll talk about those. We do also, again, surface water monitoring. Most of our monitoring sites have continuous logging equipment in them, so not just relying on, you know, monthly manual measurements, but we do have continuous water level monitoring. So that is something that we're always looking to expand our network and again analyze the data that we're getting. So I will talk about a couple projects that we're working on, and I'm going to talk about two pits, the Hill Annex and the Canisteo Mine Pit. We call them legacy mine pits, and I'll just try and better explain that and define that. So in 1980, reclamation rules were established. And so what these reclamation rules for mining do is require companies to plan for closure, and which includes, you know, what's going to happen with the water when these pits fill. The pits that were mined and abandoned pre-reclamation rules really have no rules or regulations tied to them, and there's no companies that are responsible for the any part of the site, including the rising water in the pits. Most of the pits across the Mesabi Iron Range, as well as in the Vermilion, you know, in the Cuyuna Range, they're done filling. Some of them are outflowing, but there's not really any concerns with the outflow. A lot of them stabilize before they reach an outflow. So generally, you know, in most cases, these legacy mine pits, as we call them, are not an issue. But we do have two on the range, which I'll talk about, and you know, you'll get a better understanding of what the issues are and the complexities faced with these. So first one I'm gonna talk about, again, Hill Annex Mine Pit. If you're not really familiar with the Iron Range, you have Grand Rapids to the west, Tibbing to the east. It's about midway between the two. Here's a close-up of the pit. This pit is about a little over 3 miles long at its max depth. I think it's over 360 feet. Mining ceased in this pit in the late 1970s. In 1988, a state park was established here, so I don't know if anybody's heard of the Hill Annex State Park, but it's mostly on the east end of the pit, and you access it here through the city of Calumet. So we also have Marble, and so these are the two Iron Range communities that are closest to the pit. 1991, definitely mining is done, but you can see, you know, the three separate mine pits, and like as I mentioned before, often, you know, the original pits that were mined, smaller pits, but as they fill with water, becomes one large water body. And so this is, you know, recent, or more, a little more recent, what it looks like as it's filling full of water. So we've had some monitoring wells around the pit and been collecting water level data on the pit for a number of years. In 2017, we installed a continuous logger, or, you know, monitoring equipment in the pit. I think it was around 2020, and I'll be honest, I tried not to get involved with the whole funding part of projects. That's not something I have to get too involved in. The budgeting I do, but not having to get the money. But there was some legislative funding given to help with both the Hill Annex and the Canisteo. So we used part of that money in 2021 to drill some additional superficial groundwater wells, and then in 2022, installed some additional bedrock wells were installed. Again, this is all just to help study the pit. Over the summer, we collected bathymetry data. We do have another bedrock well installation planned, hopefully for the spring. And also, hopefully starting in 2023, we'll be able to take some of this data and start moving into the modeling phase, because again, this pit is filling. And we're not sure, you know, if this pit is gonna fill till it outflows. And if so, you know, the question will be how much water will come out of this pit. So again, this is our surface water location monitoring location. And this is what we have seen with the water levels. Some pumping has happened in the pit since mine closure. This is for state park purposes. Interestingly, they used to do, they don't do them anymore, but they used to do tours of the pit, and there's actually some structures that are old mining structures that are in the pit that were covered with, you know, were underwater. But they tried to manage water levels in that pit to help aid with these tours. One, just for safety reasons, of course, and access to the pit, but you could actually, you know, never went on one of these tours, but my understanding is that you can look down at, and see some of these, the structures that are underwater. But definitely, so again, you can see here where the solid line starts, that's where our continuous water level monitoring equipment went in. So we have a good record of water level, water levels. I should say right now the water level is at about 1324. The natural pit overflow is 1368. I mentioned we installed some new groundwater wells. So the red and the yellow wells are wells that were previously there. We installed some new surficial and bedrock wells, especially in the marble area. We didn't have any before. This is the nest where we are proposing to add a third well here, a deeper groundwater well. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about the drill core real quickly. These last four bedrock wells we installed, we did not hit any competent bedrock. We were hoping we would, and we would have some core to add to our drill core library. All these wells were drilled about 300 feet. So real quick, I'll just go through. This is overburden. This is what we were not really expecting to see. We believe this is weathered Virginia slate, but I was just quite taken with this. The colors, which probably don't show up in the picture very well, but very brilliant blues and kind of purples and grays. Really interesting. We hit the Bowabic Iron Formation about where we thought we would at 105 feet, but never hit competent bedrock, and that was the case with all of these wells. So this third well we are planning to install, we are going to install to, I think, about a depth of about 600 feet and hoping to hit competent bedrocks. But, you know, even if we don't, water level data we'll get from these wells and the information we get from these wells is really useful. Real quickly, just this is a cross-section of what we're seeing right now in the groundwater. As you would expect, water is still going towards the pit. The pit is still rising. We haven't really seen any change in deep groundwater, superficial groundwater wells, a little bit of an increase. The interesting thing here is it does look like there is a groundwater divide here, because the pits, the wells to the north, still flowing, you know, into the pit. To the south, it looks like they're flowing southward. But, you know, as that water level comes up, we might see a change in the gradient. Just some pictures when we did the bathymetry data, definitely you could see some groundwater seeps coming in still, which, you know, makes sense. Pits filling rapidly. Another notable thing is the erosion, which is very common on these pits, especially as they fill in. You can tell that this pit is definitely, the water level's up above the bedrock glacial contact layer. So as the water gets farther up into the glacial material, we're probably gonna see more erosion as that wave action undercuts. But, you know, we already see quite a bit of sloughing. And there are some structures at the state park that are very close to the pit edge, and I know the parks staff are watching that close and trying to determine what, you know, what the next action is, because I know that those structures are historical. You know, they're very old, and so definitely a concern there. So, but this is right now just a graph showing what our predicted time to fill on that is. Along with our comparing to our actual monitored water levels. So we're studying this, you know, I guess is what you could say. We don't know for sure that it will run out, but this is what all our data is gonna feed into modeling to try and determine. So phase one was the data collection. Again, phase two, we won't go into this too much, but a lot of steps that need to be taken. If it determines that an outlet route it will be needed. And three potential outlet routes, these mostly based on low points along the rim, but this is what we would study if it is determined that the pit is gonna outflow, is looking at the, you know, potential impacts and whether the, you know, even if these, maybe the outlets on these lakes or the culverts, you know, we have to look at all that. Could this flow be, handled by downstream resources and what the potential impacts will be? So I think I still have a few minutes left. Real quick, I want to talk about the Canisteo mine pit. Another legacy mine, this one's located a little bit farther west near Grand Rapids, just north of the cities of Beauvais, Coleraine, and Taconite. This pit is almost 5 miles long. This is also a pit that was made up of a series of smaller pits, I think 18 or 19 different pits or operations mined in this, which is now one big complex. The max depth here is 315 feet. 1991 photo, definitely filling full of water. Mining ended in 1980, but you can still see, you know, as you look where some individual pits were. And again, this is now what it looks like, very large pit complex, full of water. To try and, you know, explain what we're doing with the Canisteo, I have to go back maybe in brief overview. As this pit's been filling for a long time, it's been a concern with stakeholders and neighboring communities for a long time. So in 1999, a two-year project with the DNR was started, installed monitoring wells, started monitoring the surface water. In 2001, the water balance study came out, and the prediction is this pit would likely keep filling till it overflowed. And I'm just giving you the highlights of this. There's been a lot going on with this pit over the years, but in 2008, there was some additional money received. You know, this DNR helped manage, but again, the DNR is partnering with all the stakeholders on, you know, both this and the Hill Annex project. But there was some additional money that was given, so they installed some additional groundwater wells. They did a pit stability study, and then looked at the different options for discharge, you know, like we might have with the Hill Annex, and trying to determine, you know, where the best route would be. And it was then determined that discharging out the west to the Prairie River would be the best. In response to rising groundwaters in the city of Beauvais, let me start over. Because of rising groundwater, people were complaining about wet basements in the city of Beauvais, and like they're saying, hey, we have water in our basement, never had water in the basement before. So the DNR did a wet basement survey and did find that, you know, there were a number of people that were being impacted by the rising groundwater. So the drain tile system was installed in 2011. And so this yellow line shows where the drain tile was installed. And so I don't know if you've ever been, if anybody's familiar with this area, as you're driving through Beauvais, it sits very low, kind of in a valley. And as the groundwater was, the rot, as the water level was coming up in the Canisteo pit, so the groundwater then was just coming out on the south rim of the pit and, you know, infiltrating really literally in people's basements in the city of Beauvais. So this drain tile was installed. And this is just a schematic of what it did, but really just, you know, digging a large trench, putting in some drain tile, and it diverted water around, groundwater around the city and lowered that water table. And I'll go back to here, my previous slide. At the end of the drain tile, it just outlets into the ditch with the rest of the city's, you know, storm sewer runoff and goes into Trout Lake. So that did help alleviate the whole wet basement part of it. In 2012, water appropriation permit was issued to a Scram mining operation. And so they pumped, well, there was one operation, Magnetation, they pumped for about till about 2017, and then in 2018, another Scram mining operation was permitted to pump. So that helped manage water levels. And so, you know, at that time, it was like, well, you know, the DNR with stakeholders was getting ready to move on a permanent outlet, but when this mining company came in, they were going to pump the work on the permanent outlets, you know, stopped. Oops. And I'll just take a minute if you can. I don't know how well these yellow dots show up, I guess pretty good. This is where we are monitoring water levels and groundwater levels on the pit. So we do have quite a big network of groundwater wells, and of course some of these were added after 2008, and we do monitor surface water levels on the pit. So okay, so this is what we're seeing though with water levels. So you can see the steep rise in water levels. The highest it got was 1318, and that was just before the magnetation and the ERPI started pumping, so you can see that that dropped water levels. Water levels are again coming up. And so, let's see what we have here. And this, then we have 1324 is delineated there. That is the runout elevation. So you can see that, you know, at 1318, before the company started dewatering, people were getting a little concerned about, you know, potential surface outlet of the pit. Groundwater wells, so again, are monitoring what, you know, I guess for what you would expect, needing to have that drain tile in. You can see the groundwater is very close to the surface there, but this is a cross section of what we're seeing for groundwater wells. Some of our wells are very much impacted by that drain tile, so some of the wells are not literally so much reflecting what we're seeing in the pit, but really very much impacted by the drain tile. So yes, we continue to monitor, and so with the rising water levels, and then with no company right now planning on pumping out of the pit, and also because it's a legacy mine pit, in around 2020 there was an ask to the legislature for money to again pick up the project where it was left off and to try and come up with a plan for a permanent outlet. During this time, we started thinking, well, maybe we should start thinking about contingency pumping. Like, what happens if we don't get this money? How high should that pit be let to rise? I'll stop here and say that when it hits 1324, it's not going to be this big wall of water, right? You're going to just see some water starting to trickle on the low points along that rim. But we knew that there were impacts as it came up with people getting water in their basements. The drain tile helped solve that. But beyond that high point at, you know, 1318, we're really not sure what impacts, you know, there are. So even though we know that outflow isn't till 1324, how high should we get it? So we started internally, did some modeling and looked at the data and came up with this contingency plan. And, you know, really what it was like, how long would it take? You know, how much time do we have before we should probably implement something? We had this plan going forward that we would potentially start contingency pumping if no money was received. Legislative session end, long story short, we didn't get any money. So we started planning on this, so we started moving forward with our contingency plan. I can't talk about the Canisteo and with the contingency pumping without saying that zebra mussels were discovered in September this year, which means that we cannot dewater that pit without treatment of zebra mussels. So that threw a little bit of a wrinkle into our contingency plans, but we're still now, the plan now is to pump that pit. And again, this is a temporary measure until, you know, we get a permanent outlet. But it has been shown that zebra mussels do not reproduce in the winter, and so they're no live villagers, and the villagers are the small larva. I've learned way more about zebra mussels than I ever thought I would with this project. But so the very small larva are the ones that float. They're not heavy enough, they don't attach like the adult zebra mussels. So those are the ones that you're concerned about, right, if you're dewatering. Those are the ones you can transfer. Well, in the winter, they drop out of the water column. I don't know if it's the cold temperatures themselves or just the lack of oxygen, but they are not present in the water column. And so the answer to that is right now we're gonna pump over the winter. And so right now we're actually getting ready to start pumping this pit, coming up with a filtration plan. Very complicated. There's not a lot of options out there that can filter at the small 25 micron size mesh that it takes to filter out these zebra mussels. So winter pumping is the answer. So the plan right now is we're just going to pump the heck out of this thing we can in the winter and keep managing water levels that way in the pit until there's money to implement the plan. And again, over the years, there's been a lot of planning. We know that it's gonna go to the Prairie River. There's outlet planning, but of course now we have to plan for the zebra mussels, which is, you know, gonna add a lot, again, complexity to this project. So right now where we're at is winter pumping and ongoing, we're gonna just continue to collect data and do further model refinement. Predicted water levels, plotted against actual water levels, and And at this scale, you can see the big dip down in water levels from the drought in 2021. But generally, it's hovering around about where we would expect. And again, pretty similar to the hill annex, about 5 to 7 feet a year, but depends on climate. So again, the contingency pumping, you know, we determined that we didn't want that water level to go above 1318, which was the high water level, highest maximum water level recorded, just because we knew at that point that the drain tile system worked and there weren't any other issues. But again, we didn't know what potential impacts there could be above that. So that is why, you know, when you look at right now, we're about 1311, decided that it would probably be best to just try to start managing water levels now. We will be dewatering via the same route that the previous scram mining operator dewatered. So that gives us a little bit of comfort. We know that, you know, the outlet, the lake outlet and all the culverts and everything downstream can handle this amount of water. There are smelt in the Canisteo pit, another invasive species that we cannot transfer. This is a picture of the existing smelt screens that we're having them repaired, but we also cannot transfer smelt. So we have two invasive species that we're dealing with the Canisteo pit. Picture of the pumps right now ready to turn on. We just have some extra work to do. But real quick, this is the dewatering route out the west, or sorry, east end of the Canisteo pit. This crosses under Highway 7, under 169, and into Holman Lake, and this eventually goes into the Swan River. And again, this is where previous operator pumped. So this is the permanent outlet is proposed to be out the very west end, and goes through a series of mine into the Prairie River. And this is just a close-up of that route. I think I'm over time. I know I went very fast at the end. Thank you.
We have time for one question.
And feel free to reach out to me. I mean, easy to find via email too if you have other questions.